Welcome to Tampa Bay FM's Synergy Connection, where life as you currently live it can be transformed into the life you've always dreamed of. Understanding your synergistic connections is the pathway to your emotional, physical, spiritual, and mental wellness. Let's begin connecting the dots. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Synergy Connection Show. Today is Thursday, May the 2nd, and I have as my returning guest, Dr. Paula Nelson. Our topic this morning is the chemically dependent family. And as you may recall, Dr. Nelson is a licensed clinical social worker who helps individuals as well as families deal with addictions and traumas. On February 7th, she was with me, and she spoke about a particular technique called EMDR, which stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. This method has been highly successful for individuals suffering from trauma. So anybody out there that needs her to do or explain what the EMDR technique was all about, she'd be happy to work with you or explain it. Today, however, we're going to be talking about how an entire family can be affected when one of their members drinks excessively or uses drugs to the point of addiction. So welcome back, Paula. I'm glad to have you here.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for having me back. I'm excited to talk about this topic because it actually affects so many of us. About one out of five of us was raised in a chemically dependent family. And this, you know, a chemical dependence runs in families. It's a genetic disease and you're predisposed to it. So not only does it run in families, but 50% of the adult children of alcoholics or addicts end up marrying an alcoholic or an addict or becoming one themselves.
So what's the reason? I mean, I realize that that is true, not only that it's genetic, but also that there is this tendency to search out the mother or the father as a spouse, you know, and you grew up in that family, and you probably said to yourself, at least at some point, there is no way in the world that I am ever going to marry somebody like my mom or like my dad, and yet it happens. So what's the reason it happens?
Right. And I don't think that we intend on this. It's an unconscious move. You know, we unconsciously choose someone like mom or dad to heal those childhood wounds. So, you know, we may end up in a relationship where in the beginning there was no substance abuse or dependence. And as time goes on, it develops. And then it's like, oh my goodness, how did I find myself here?
Right. Now, I know there are organizations that also help children of adult alcoholics is one of them, but just help you to understand that there will be that tendency. So, I mean, if people plugged into it maybe earlier in the game, before they get married, they might be able to avoid that particular situation.
Right. You know, if you can heal those childhood wounds before you get involved in an intimate relationship, that would be the preference. You know, that would be the ideal.
Right.
But, you know, there's the roles and behaviors and attitudes that people take on in a chemically dependent family because when someone is chemically dependent, and I'm going to use a stereotypical approach and say the dad, you know, if dad is alcoholic, you know, and that is a stereotype, I know, but it's easier to address it that way.
Right.
If dad's alcoholic, he is focused on the alcohol. He's focused on getting alcohol, using alcohol, recovering from alcohol, hiding the alcohol use. So he's not emotionally present
for either the wife or the kids.
Right.
Yeah. And there was a situation that I had when I still had my therapy practice, and I was just absolutely dumbfounded, I guess would be a good word to use, because this was a guy who would, you know, he told his wife. Now, a lot of alcoholics kind of can hold their alcohol, and so you're not always aware that they've been drinking. But he had told his wife that he only would have a couple of beers on his way home. Mm-hmm. In reality, he later confessed to me that he would pick up a case of beer.
My.
And by the time he would get home, because he would go someplace and drink for a while.
Right.
But he would have all of these, and they were bottles. They weren't cans.
Oh, my gosh.
So he would have all of these beer bottles in his car.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would have to find some place to get rid of them, so it only appeared that he had a few.
Right.
So probably every other day he was going through a case of beer.
Yeah, because the more you use, the more you build tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your cells actually change shape to accommodate
the alcohol.
More and more alcohol until you're in the late stages of the disease where the cells break down.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens a lot with the elderly. The elderly, if they have built tolerance and continue to drink, they can have one or two drinks and feel the effects, be off to the races, just like it was when you first started drinking.
And that's because of the cellular breakdown?
Right, right. And, you know, your body is just not ridding, you know, the liver is not capable of ridding your body of the alcohol. So when you take a drink, you're adding to what's already there.
I see.
You're not starting with an empty tank there.
All right.
Yeah.
That makes sense because cirrhosis of the liver is a gradual disease.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're really saying is that once you get to that maximum capacity,
right,
then it only takes one or two to go over the top.
Right, right.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So families take on roles to cope with this.
Mm-hmm.
Because normally in the chemically dependent family, nobody's talking about this. Nobody's talking about this.
It's the secret.
It is. It's the family secret.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit crazy making because nobody's talking about it, but everyone feels it and
right.
Everyone knows it. So there's a lot of anxiety. And
that the secret will be discovered.
Or a lot of anxiety in that, is it me or is it hot in here? You know, when the family's not talking about it, you wonder, is it me or is it hot in here? Am I crazy or is this really happening?
Mm-hmm.
So there's anxiety and people unconsciously take on roles to cope with the tension in the family and their own anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've got the chemically dependent person and then you've got the prime enabler. The prime enabler is the person who loves the chemically dependent person the most, usually a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, a mom.
Could be
when
a
it's
child.
A kid. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so the prime enabler, they enable, basically.
Mm-hmm.
They enable the chemically dependent person to continue to use. So they pick up all of the responsibilities. They're cleaning up the messes. They're lying to friends and family about why we can't attend this party or why we left early or, you know, what happened here. And, you know, they take on all the chores. If the chemically dependent person loses their job, they'll pick up another job. So the prime enabler is stressed to the max, trying to take care, keep things together in the family.
Mm-hmm.
While the chemically dependent person is using. So you've got the chemically dependent person who is focused on the chemical,
mm-hmm.
alcohol or drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the prime enabler who's totally focused on the chemically dependent person, the person they love the most, who's
and
using.
Trying to get them healthy.
Right. And then there's no one there for the children.
Right.
Yeah. Nobody's attending to the children in that family.
Hmm. So it's an extremely expensive, you know, emotionally as well as financially situation for the entire family.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, if you do have either the male or the female spouse covering for the one who is using alcohol and or drugs,
mm-hmm.
how often do families do both? I mean, I personally had seen this where I had, like, let's say the alcoholic person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you had the other partner who was actually using, Quaaludes or, something to cope and keep the anxiety at bay or keep the tension reduced. And so then you had two addictions going.
Right. And that's how the whole codependency movement started, you know, where you're codependent. You're both you know, developing your own addictions in order to cope. In my family system, my mother was alcoholic, and my father developed a gambling addiction to
support her alcoholism?
No, just get out of the house.
Oh, and, just get out. Okay.
Yeah, to escape her alcoholism.
Okay.
You know, he developed this whole other world, you know, of friends and activity. He was out all the time at the casinos and at the horse races, you know, and became addicted to gambling in response.
How many times did you find that, let's say, a person with anxiety or depression that had not been diagnosed because, you know, the dual diagnosis that you and I both know. So that sometimes is hiding behind the addiction.
Yes.
Is that there is an original issue and then the way they've learned to cope is to use drugs or alcohol.
Right.
So how many times did you find that those couples met each other, and because there was that,
that dynamic,
they just kind of recognized each other and went, oh, you're like me, and so we can kind of go off into the sunset together, only to play this out again.
Right. It's so frequent that there's actually an ongoing joke about that, where if you put an alcoholic and an ACOA, an adult child of an alcoholic, in a crowded party together, they are magnetically drawn to one another. It happens so frequently that it's, you know, become a joke in the addiction community. It's sad.
I don't know whether you'll relate to this or not, but I used to explain to people that I was working with that we all have antenna that basically are growing out of the top of our heads. They're invisible, but they're there. And so they kind of work on these little swivels. And that would be like the party you're talking about if you had two at either end. But that there are the people in the world that their little antenna are looking for someone to take care of them. And then you have the other person in the world that wants to take care of someone. Yeah. And so instead of having two healthy individuals spending time together, you have somewhat two dysfunctional individuals that either narcissistically or otherwise are looking and then finding that other person who goes, oh, no problem, I can fix you. I'll come in and I'll rescue you and make things all better.
Yeah.
And you probably see that all the time.
Again, it goes back to the codependency. You know, I'm depending on you to take care of me and you're depending on me to be taking, you know, to be a caretaker, you know, to be taken care of, you know. So,
And then the resentment that grows from the one who is the caregiver.
Right.
Because after a while, it's like, well, wait a minute. I have needs too and you're not meeting my needs.
Right.
So, well, so the patterns exist, don't they?
Yeah. So the research shows that children take on four patterns or four roles, four patterns of behavior in these families. They did research, and this, of course, is on a family of four. But, you know, this changes as well because some families have different generations. You can have three kids and then there's a gap and then you have two or three other kids, you know, so there can be these roles in both generations. Or when, you know, people leave the family, grow up and leave and go off to college or you know, leave the home, people change roles. Like, these aren't fixed roles, but this is what the research has shown, that, you know, while you have the chemically dependent focused on the chemical and the prime enabler focused on the chemically dependent person, the kids come into the system and take on these roles, these patterns of behavior, these attitudes.
So let's say that we have the first child being born. At what age does that child begin to assume a role.
It's kids are very intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
So they pick up on the tension early on. So you're talking, you know, preschool already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they pick up, you know, dad and mom are fighting, and kids are very narcissistic.
Mm-hmm.
The world revolves around them. So I remember when my parents would fight, I would hear them fighting in the other room. I would think to myself, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And it probably had nothing to do with me, but that's how kids think, that it's because of me. So the first kid comes into the system and sees dad, you know, and mom fighting, feels the tension. And even before they're cognitively aware or can verbalize what's happening, they unconsciously feel that it's their fault. And if they are a really, really good kid, if they get straight A's, if they make that sports team, if they are perfect, if their room is neat, if they're neat and clean, then mom and dad won't fight. And everything's going to be okay.
Okay, so they take on the perfectionistic role.
Yeah, the hero, the family hero.
Yeah.
You know, so the unconscious...
And it doesn't make any difference if it's male or female. It's going to be mostly just the firstborn that can do no wrong.
Right, right.
Okay.
You know, and so unconsciously, the thought is, I can fix my family.
Mm-hmm.
I can fix this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What a huge responsibility, though.
Right, right.
Huge.
Right. You know, but this role does serve a purpose because this child makes the family look good to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
If this kid is perfect, then there's nothing wrong with that family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this kid gets straight A's. There can't be anything wrong with that family.
So in a way, they are camouflaging,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's really underneath.
Right.
So if the world looks at me, they're going to think we are okay.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now we have the second child being born, because usually families such as this, you know, I guess I might even say unfortunately, but I mean, you know, they do have sex, and so they do have babies.
Mm-hmm.
And so another baby is on the way, and you have to hope that there's not domestic violence going
on.
But
right.
sometimes with both drugs and alcohol, you can have domestic violence taking place during a pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I
That
really impacts the baby, not just the physical violence that could take place, but babies in utero feel.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I mean, you don't have to be drinking or doing drugs.
Right.
But they feel those emotions coming from their mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so that affects how they're doing on a cellular level as they're developing.
Right.
So that's another scary thing.
It is.
So now we have baby number two.
Right.
All right. So what happens as baby number two sees, oh, I have a sister or brother that is perfect.
Perfect.
So what's my role?
Right, right. So the second baby also tries to be a hero, but can't compete with, you know, brother or sister.
Right.
That role's already taken.
Right.
So the second child feels rejected from the family. Every time he or she tries to compete with the hero, it's like, well, oh, I see you got a B. Well, Johnny got all A's. You know, or why can't you do this like Sally did?
Right.
You know, there's always that comparison. So the second child feels rejected by the family system and looks outside the family system for connection.
So where do they go find that connection?
Usually to their peers.
Okay.
Okay, usually in school or in the neighborhood. And unfortunately, they make that connection with peers who have also been rejected by their family. You know, it's that feeling like, oh, you know, I can relate. I've been rejected too. I mean, they don't say that consciously,
right.
But it's that feeling of we're all outsiders. So let's make our own family outside of our families. And so this kid is known as the scapegoat because he or she hooks up with another peer group that has behavioral problems usually.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And gets into trouble. There's truancy, there's, drug and alcohol use when, they hit, the middle school.
Mm-hmm. They can start earlier and earlier these days.
Yeah, they are, yeah. And the girls, the girl scapegoats, oftentimes will become unwed mothers, mm-hmm. Have unwed pregnancies, because this way they could have someone just that they can love and will mm-hmm. love only them.
Right.
I can have my own family. I can make my own family. Right. So this is the scapegoat.
I'm going to share a little bit of a twist here
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
without naming, obviously, names. But a number of years ago, I was working in a program where families had been pulled apart by alcoholism and or drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of my job was to literally reunify them based upon making sure that they were ready to be reunified.
That's a challenge.
It was a huge challenge. But I remember a story in particular about siblings who had relocated from another state.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being is that I guess the father in the other state had been murdered, as well as the mother.
Ugh.
And so there was no one to take
mm-hmm.
these children.
Oh, gosh.
And so they had to go with a relative that was here in the state of Florida.
Mm.
And it turned out that the older sibling, had watched this. His family was heavily involved in the drug cartel in this state.
Oh.
And so there were regular shootings that they had been witnessing. And I remember him telling me that when he opened the refrigerator door, there was never anything in there except drugs and lettuce.
Oh,
and I don't know why lettuce, but lettuce was what was there. So there was no food
mm-hmm.
for these kiddos.
Mm.
And so I spent months, working with this family. But the older one took over after his parents were killed, took right over and became the head of this particular organization.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a teenager still.
Oh,
but
gosh.
He could not leave the home because he would be shot. So his brother became the runner.
Okay.
And so in this case, the oldest one was not the perfectionist.
I can
do no wrong.
Right.
He was falling right into his parents' footsteps
mm-hmm.
because somebody had to pay the bills.
Oh.
And in this case, he said that his, the money that came in was ridiculous, but he would roll around on the floor on top of all of this money he could spend, and yet he could not go shop.
Leave.
He couldn't leave. He couldn't do anything. And so then his brother would go get the things that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they got here and they were in more of a protective setting, he threatened his brother and said, you will not do what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And yet
mm-hmm.
the brother followed right along in the same footsteps. And so, it's just interesting how, I guess if it's a family that's dysfunctional at such a high degree of dysfunctionality.
Yeah.
This could happen where you just, I'm part of the cartel. I'm moving
right
in. I have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And yet if it's maybe a mom and dad down the block and mom or dad are drinking or doing drugs, then you can have a child who says, okay, I'm going to defer
mm-hmm.
all of this attention onto me because I'm going to be perfect.
Right.
So I thought that was such an interesting
way
of his approach
mm-hmm.
versus maybe some other kid's approach.
And that's a good example of how these roles aren't fixed.
Mm-hmm.
They can change, they can morph, as the role in the family changes, you take on different roles.
Right. And he really had no choice
mm-hmm.
in his mind.
I know in my family system, my sister was the hero. She was the firstborn, and my sister was the hero, and she was perfect, and I resented it and couldn't compete with her, and so I became the scapegoat. And then when she left and went to college, because she was about 7 years older than I was, When she left and went to college, then I took over the hero role.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was it a conscious decision? Like, wow, she's gone, now I can be?
No, it was this, the whole thing was I didn't consciously choose to be the scapegoat either. I didn't want to get in all that trouble.
But, and yet you did.
Yeah, yet I did. So.
Well, in a way, it's kind of nice because now as a therapist, you can honestly say,
been there, done that. Yeah. But it is very unconscious. We don't consciously say, okay, I'm gonna fix this, I'm gonna be perfect, or uh-huh. I feel rejected, I'm gonna go get in trouble. You know, it's just these roles occur unconsciously. But even the scapegoat serves a purpose for the chemically dependent family in that the attention then goes on to the scapegoat. This kid's always in trouble. You know, mm-hmm. they're always being called into school, there's behavioral problems, there's, you know, gangs, addiction, da-da-da-da. And so the focus, the shift goes on to the scapegoat in that we would be fine if it wasn't for that kid. You know, if it wasn't
he's
for...
he's taking or she's taking all of the time and attention.
Yeah, you know, right. So the focus isn't on the chemically dependent anymore. Mm-hmm. It's not on the alcohol use or the drug use. It's on the scapegoat getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you another question here, you know, as we go, because addictions, there's what, 11 or 13?
I know there's
a lot of addictions that people can have. So let's just say that it's not alcohol, it's mm-hmm. not drugs, mm-hmm. maybe it's gambling, like mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier, maybe it's, you know, people that are overeaters, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, because that's an addiction, mm-hmm. maybe it's sex. I mean, I know there's a lot of different addictions mm-hmm. that can create mm-hmm. issues for families. So in a case where it's not alcohol mm-hmm. and it's not drugs, these roles would still be played out in the family, because if you had a parent who was gone all the time, mm-hmm. then, right. you know, to make it easier for maybe the remaining parent, whether it's the mom gone all the time or dad gone all the time,
right?
Then the kids are still going to be, I'm the perfectionist because I won't want to rock the boat. Mm-hmm. I'm the one who's in trouble and never measuring up.
Right.
And
right.
I'm maybe the baby. Mm-hmm. And so I get a lot of attention because of being a baby.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah. They found that these roles exist even in families where there's just family dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a mental health issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe there's no chemical dependence or behavioral addictions. It may be mom is severely depressed.
Right, right.
And lives behind that closed bedroom door.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids will take on those roles, again, unconsciously.
And I'm also thinking, you know, this isn't exactly an addiction, but I do think there's family patterns that happen
mm-hmm.
Where it's just some families that I've known from even back where I had my private practice, where there was illness.
Mm, yeah.
And so mom and or dad, you know, may have been diagnosed with a chronic illness.
Right.
And so then the family roles, you know, become well-defined where...
Good point.
No, mm-hmm. I can't, you know, I can't express myself because they've got enough on their plate.
Right, right.
And so, you know, the good kid internalizes mm-hmm. and then ends up with other kinds of maybe health issues themselves.
Right.
Or the other one is acting out because they can't deal with the fact that mom or dad maybe are, you know, not only chronically ill, but terminally ill.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so... I don't
know.
That's
a good point.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that mm-hmm. the families do take roles. And I worked in Missouri with a children's home.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that we help kids actually deal with a lot of their own frustration from the family dynamics that were going on is we had these soft bats. I don't know
uh-huh.
whether you've ever seen
yeah,
them or not.
Yeah.
And I remember I was in my internship.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had ever, you know, like, come after me with a bat like that. I mean, even though it was soft, it could, you know.
Sure.
And so he said, no, you have to understand what it's like to be hit. You know, somebody coming after
you goodness.
And hitting you. And I was just dumbfounded because I highly dislike that. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, right.
There were all kinds of red flags coming up. But it helped me understand the fear
mm-hmm.
that a child sometimes can face, in a domestic violence situation. Not only that they might be involved by deflecting
mm-hmm.
the violence, mm-hmm. but also witnessing.
Right, right.
And so it was a very powerful lesson.
Oh, my.
So
how scary.
Have a soft bat in your office there.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my.
So. What we learn as therapists, right? Holy moly.
Oh, that is scary. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The family organizes itself around the problem, whether mm-hmm. it's an addiction or a chronic disease or a mental health issue.
Right.
The family organizes itself around it, and the focus of that family becomes that addiction or that chronic illness
right.
or that disease.
Right.
So,
almost all of their waking hours, once the diagnosis
exhausting.
Or not is made, but once your kiddos become aware
mm-hmm.
of whatever those dynamics are, yeah, their whole life is spent revolving around that identified person.
Right, right. So. And it's so intuitive. I mean, we really underestimate children.
Mm-hmm.
They are so intuitive, and we're always shocked when they come out with these zingers or these, insights. We're like, how do they know?
Mm-hmm.
But they sense it,
mm-hmm.
On a feelings level. They sense the dysfunction in the family, the tension, the anxiety, the anger.
Well, animals do that too.
Mm.
Because I don't know how many people have pets, but there are so many times when I hear somebody saying, oh, my dog comes and lays, his or her head in my lap and seems to know when I need affection.
Right, right.
And so they can give it unconditionally,
mm-hmm.
whereas maybe you might feel that there are strings attached if it's a human being doing it.
Yeah.
and so cats don't do it as much, I don't think, as mm-hmm. dogs do.
Right. Right.
But, I have a cat that intuitively knows the energy of people. And so she will come out
uh-huh.
if she wants to be seen, and she feels like the energy is a very calm energy.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I would say 95% of the time she stays hidden until yeah. after they leave, and then she reappears and kind of says, okay, I'm okay now. So it's interesting. I don't know about birds or rabbits or things like that, mm-hmm. but horses. Horses are highly knowledgeable
mm-hmm.
of what people need, so that's why they use them in therapy.
Yeah, a lot of therapy. Mm-hmm. So we've got the chemically dependent, we've got the prime enabler, we have the hero,
mm-hmm.
we've got the scapegoat. Now the next child comes into the system and senses this chaos again,
mm-hmm.
senses this chaos. And knows, they can't compete with the hero. The scapegoat's always getting in trouble. So this child thinks, I'm not going to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
Again, unconsciously, I'm not going to rock the boat. I'm just going to stay in my room and I'm going to play on my computer. Or I'm going to play my video games. Or
have
I'm
my
gonna,
headphones on.
Right, have my headphones on. Read my books. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what they call the lost child.
Mm.
And the lost child, again, provides relief to the family, plays a role, provides relief to the family, and that at least they don't have to worry about that one.
Yeah. Because they're doing something that's okay.
Well, it's like they don't exist.
Mm.
They disappear completely.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually the lost child. Unfortunately, this child, like the other children in the family, develop their own issues as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Because this child lives in his or her room, they grow up to be socially awkward and often develop a social phobia and are prescribed sedatives or anti-anxiety drugs because they're so anxious going out of that room and out into the world.
Do they sometimes have academic issues as a result of that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So they might not even get identified until they get to school.
Right, right. And even in school, I mean, it's the lost child. They disappear in the crowd.
Right.
And it's interesting because I have clients who have identified as lost children when we talk about this in session, and they're always the people that if they cancel a session, I have to like make note to remember to reach out to them to reschedule, or because they'll get lost even in the therapeutic setting.
I'm not important enough.
They disappear.
Right.
So you know, each of these children have the potential of developing their own addiction as adults. Mm-hmm. So with the social phobia, with the social anxiety, they're usually prescribed anti-anxiety drugs, which are highly addictive.
Right.
The Xanax, right. The benzodiazepines, right. Which are, you know, highly, you know, they'll develop their own addiction.
I'm going to share another little story here that will probably add a different dimension slightly. One of the gals that I worked with many years ago now, she had 17 personalities.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I would always know which personality was mostly coming to session because, you know, the objective was to integrate the personalities. And one was a little girl that was probably around 5 or 6, and she loved to come because she loved the attention.
Mm-hmm.
So in somebody who has multiple personalities like that, each one is, she, one of her favorite go-to drugs was Xanax.
Yeah.
And back in those days, you could get prescriptions from many different doctors because they didn't always coordinate.
Right, right.
So she would have stashes. Oh. Yeah, she had stashes. Mm. And she would sell them for additional money at times. But the thing that I found really amazing is that each one of the personalities, some were healthier than others.
Mm-hmm.
Some had different roles in their family of origin than others. And they had different addictions.
Oh, my.
So the person that was maybe 21, 22 loved hanging out in the bars.
Mm-hmm.
And so her addiction was alcohol. And the one that was in her 30s that had anxiety, you know, was using drugs.
Oh,
and another one that was in her 20s, 18, 19, 20, someplace along in there, loved speed.
Oh.
And so she, you know, was using that.
Oh, my goodness.
And so you never knew which, not only which personality was coming to visit, but which addiction was also going to be behind the scenes.
Right, right.
So that's a whole nother can
of worms. Oh, my gosh. That's a whole show.
That is a whole show all by itself.
I know. I would love to hear how you worked with her. That is... Oh.
One time I can't even imagine. Yeah. One time she showed up and I really liked her. And normally people that have, it's called MPD, but multiple personality disorders, typically they will not stay with a therapist for very long because if you begin to integrate, they're very resistant to that.
Mm-hmm.
And she did stay with me for 2.5 years, which was almost unheard
of. That's amazing.
But one year she showed up with this gigantic bear at Christmas time. And all I could see was the top of the bear's hat because she had it on her lap.
Uh-huh.
So it looked like somebody sitting in the chair that was a big bear
instead
of. And so she was very, very sweet at times. There were a few times when the personality that showed up wanted to do damage. And I had to actually watch because I had... You know, I had to talk her out of a knife once.
Oh, my.
So, you know, it's, you never know. And and not only, like I said, the personality, you're having to deal with a separate kind of addiction because of whatever trauma, you know, had taken place.
She must have had horrendous trauma.
She did. Oh, my. She did. To have that many personalities, you really do.
Yeah. And growing up in families like this is traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people just kind of repress it all.
Right.
You know, when I have clients, you know, who are adult children of alcoholics, I'm always looking to use EMDR,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
to go back to the childhood history and,
right.
and heal those traumas.
I don't even know if EMDR would work in that case, quite honestly, because
yeah.
you don't know what's going to trigger them.
Right.
And
right.
so the objective is always to keep yourself safe
mm-hmm.
as well as them safe.
Yeah.
And if you trigger something that you can't manage in that 50 minutes or hour and a half,
right.
depending on the session,
mm-hmm.
better not to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it would require a lot of safety and preparation.
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
So the lost child then, like I said, probably doesn't get identified until they
mm-hmm.
get to school, because that's when teachers begin to go, okay, there's something a little different here.
Right.
And at
right.
home, they're just like, oh, I don't have to
Perfect.
Worry about that
yeah.
one.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. right. And then finally, the baby is born into the system.
So now we have four kids?
Yeah. This
or
is,
there could be six or eight kids,
yeah.
but it'll be the youngest.
Right,
okay.
right.
Okay.
So everyone in the family learns to protect the baby. If there's fighting going on in the house, the baby will walk in the room and it'll all be hush-hush. It'll
oh,
all stop.
Okay.
So the baby has no idea that dad is alcoholic. Or that mom is exhausted trying to take care of everything.
Mm-hmm.
The baby doesn't know what trouble the scapegoat's in. You know, the baby is basically clueless. Everybody tries to treat, you know, make everything look normal.
Right. For, well, hence the name baby.
Right, right.
We're protecting the baby.
But the baby knows something's wrong.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
kids are intuitive.
Right.
And it is. It's kind of like, is it me or is it hot in here?
Right.
Okay, well, it's got to be me, you know.
So the baby identifies that it's their problem,
right? That they're, you know, that they're crazy, that there's everything's fine, and that must be them. So what they do is they become the jokester in the family. They become what they call the mascot, where they, to relieve their own anxiety and any tension they sense in the family, they make jokes. They become the comic.
Oh,
they,
so the class clown.
The class clown
at home.
Yeah, and at school.
Maybe at school too.
Yeah,
this is
what happens in school. They develop behavioral problems
mm-hmm.
because they can never be serious. And you probably know people like this,
mm-hmm.
even as adults,
mm-hmm.
where you try to have a serious conversation or an intimate conversation with them, and they're just making jokes.
Happens all the time.
It's so,
I mean, in the workplace, I even see it happening. You know, I used to do the Myers-Briggs.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've probably done that test too. But when you identify the different personality patterns, and then you, on top of it, you know, can look at maybe potential, at least,
mm-hmm.
dysfunction
mm-hmm.
within the families that you're not even talking about. You're just trying to figure out how a group can work together.
Right.
And then you have somebody in that group at a workplace that is the clown that's constantly
mm-hmm.
laughing, constantly
mm-hmm.
deflecting. Then you know, like, okay, we have some issues here.
It's frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
It's really frustrating
mm-hmm.
because you sit down to have a serious conversation and it just can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not capable of it. And this is the kid that usually ends up being diagnosed with ADD or ADHD
mm-hmm.
in school, because there's so much anxiety that this child is constantly on stage,
right,
you know,
right.
acting out,
right.
you know, entertaining the class.
Right.
So again, this child can develop his or her own addiction because they're prescribed, you know, the ADHD meds or ADD meds, which are stimulants,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, and they can become addicted to the central nervous system stimulants,
mm-hmm.
or they're prescribed, you know, again, sedatives and anti-anxiety meds, and can also develop their own addiction. But they do serve a purpose, again, for the family. They provide the comic relief.
Right. All right. I'm going to bring up another thing that it kind of dovetails into this that
uh-huh.
I'm sure you've run into as well. A lot of times kids are identified as ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
The teachers will say that. Parents will say that. In reality,
mm-hmm.
what they have is bipolar disorder. because it mimics ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I used to find is that if a child had been identified and I brought a parent in, and I started asking similar questions, you know, like, how do you handle having a lot of different things to do? And I would find that at work or at home, they were using Post-its. Because Post-its, they could finish the task, they would see the task, then they would throw it away. But if they tried to keep it in their head, they couldn't.
Okay.
So I'm also thinking that there are going to be times when the either bipolar or ADHD personality, and if you give stimulants to bipolar, that is really, really, really bad.
Yeah.
They just don't do well.
Right. Right.
But so you can get a misdiagnosis with a misdiagnosed prescription being offered to that individual.
Right.
And then they are in turn going to be saying, my God, I need a drink. Or my goodness, I need to smoke pot or something to calm down.
Yeah.
So now you have multiple problems taking place because the diagnosis was wrong to begin with. So it seems like we've got an onion in many respects.
Yes.
And you have the person kind of at the core of the onion, and they may have an addiction, whether it's alcohol, drugs, or something else.
Right, right.
But as you peel back the layers and you find out the role they had in the family, or you find out that maybe the diagnosis was incorrect for them coming out of that family,
right,
that it takes a tremendous skill to be able to identify what's really going on in order to make the problem better.
Right, right. So many layers.
So many layers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there is a lot of misdiagnosis when it comes to ADD and ADHD.
Well, and how they became addicted to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that happened back in childhood or early adulthood, and they used other kinds of methods for coping, then here we go to the races.
Right,
you know, we've
right.
got this issue, but now we're using this addiction to cope with this issue. None of it's easy.
No. You know, and again, if left untreated, each of these kids grow up and can develop their own addiction.
Mm-hmm.
The hero grows up with a chronic feeling of inadequacy. And I see this a lot, you know, with or without addiction. People who come in who are coming from a family where there's been an addiction or the mental illness, the family organized around the mental illness or a chronic disease, and the person comes in and says, I feel like I'm not good enough, I'm not worthwhile, I lack self-esteem, you know, oftentimes it's that family hero that unconsciously wanted to fix the family and wasn't able to
get the job done,
you know, because no matter what you do as a kid, you can get all, you know, straight A's, get on every team, whatever, you can be the perfect child, but you can't fix your family.
Right.
So they grow up with a chronic feeling of inadequacy. So what the hero usually does is becomes perfectionistic, like you were saying, will become a workaholic, may develop their own addiction because, you know, they want to be perfect, either, you know, the stimulants in order to be able to do more and more and more, or the alcohol, you know, to calm themselves, or other, you know, drugs that for calming.
And I don't think a lot of workaholics, honestly and truly, see that as an addiction, but it is, because their life is so out of balance.
Yeah, because they're not emotionally available.
Mm-mm.
You know, they may be excellent at what they do. Heroes usually are excellent at what they do.
Right.
But they're not emotionally available to family or to intimate relationships.
Right.
But
I suspect it's pretty scary for them because they have to step out of that role that they're in order to be emotionally available.
Yeah, the family hero is the most difficult to treat. Because the family hero is getting all these kudos for being perfect.
Right.
You know, so why give that up?
Right.
You know, it's like,
I like all those stars behind my name.
Yeah, right. Right. So, you know, that person is the most difficult to treat. And what they often do is they'll marry someone who has an addiction or ends up with a mental health or chronic disease,
mm-hmm.
Because
so they can still be a hero,
and fix the family.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So then they step into the role of the prime enabler.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
there's a whole bunch of all of us that have gone into the helping professions, mm-hmm. whether it's ministry work or caregivers or social work or whatever it is, that probably enjoyed, at least at some point in our life, being a fixer. Identifying, oh, I know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at some point you go, you know what? I don't think I want to do that anymore.
Yeah, I know. I know. I always tell my friends and family, if you're going to go to therapy, find a therapist who's been through therapy, because
right.
most helpers,
right.
Had that unconscious desire to fix their families,
mm-hmm.
and unless they work that out, then that could get messy.
It definitely could. Well, in our remaining minutes, what do you want to maybe make sure that people understand about the chemically dependent family?
Well, I think that it's important to understand that this is very prevalent. Again, it's about 43% of us, grew up.
Entire population, huh?
Entire population.
Wow.
And also know that there's help out there. There's actually a 12-step program for mm-hmm. adult children. In Florida, it's called ACA. And you can look at adultchildren.org.
Mm-hmm.
They have readings out there, and there are 12-step meetings for people who have grown up in chemically dependent families or dysfunctional families. However, I usually recommend that if you're going to ACA meetings, make sure you're seeing a therapist as well, because this is a self-help group. There's no therapist there.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings up a lot of feelings. And,
mm-hmm.
and if you have no place to process this with
mm-hmm.
somebody who is a professional and
right.
has this background, you're left with a lot of just raw feelings and may anesthetize those some way
mm-hmm.
yourself. So
mm-hmm. That's really good advice,
yeah.
because I think sometimes you don't want to disclose.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's not as much social stigma today as there used to be about seeing a therapist.
Right, right.
But there's still, the ability of saying, I can't do this myself.
Mm-hmm.
I need. And it's not your best friend that's going to be able to help you through it.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah,
your best friend is going to tell you what you want to hear. It's just about in those families, we were taught don't talk, don't trust,
mm-hmm.
don't feel.
And now you're being told to do exactly what you were told not to do.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You want to... meet with a therapist that you can trust, where
mm-hmm.
you feel safe and you can have a voice and learn how to identify and express your feelings,
mm-hmm.
Learn how to talk, trust, and feel, because you need that in order to have quality, intimate relationships as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are some adults that never get there? They try, and maybe they try again,
mm-hmm.
and they just can't resolve everything. And so, maybe they end their life at 90 or 80 or whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
From normal causes, but wishing that they had somehow understood
yeah.
a little bit better and
yeah.
just never got there.
Yeah, I coulda, shoulda, woulda.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you remember the book, Coulda, Shoulda, Woulda?
No.
It was actually a title, and it was very popular back in, I'm going to say, the early 80s, maybe?
Oh, my gosh.
I think it's still available.
Good title.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
a great title.
Mm-hmm.
Really great title.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So I want people to also understand how to find you if they are looking for assistance in working through some of these adult patterns of behavior today,
mm-hmm.
or they have unresolved childhood
right.
issues that they're coping with today as adults. So how would they find you?
I am at Bayshore in Michigan Boulevards in Dunedin. And I can be reached at 813-951-8889. I also work with people who suffer from addictions.
Mm-hmm.
So give me a call, 813-951-8889, and we can talk and see if we're a fit.
And I do think that's important. I'm glad you bring that up, because not every therapist is going to be a perfect fit for somebody.
Right.
But I think if you can, you know, talk to somebody on the phone,
mm-hmm.
most people have at least a feeling that, okay, this person listens, or
right.
this person, I can maybe just sense a vibrational quality,
right?
You know, that
right.
it's a gentle vibration.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I've talked to some individuals in business,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, oh my goodness, I would never want to work with them. Because you can sense somehow,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it's going to be a very difficult
right.
relationship. And so why walk down that road,
right,
you know, if you don't have to?
Exactly.
What about, do you recommend, let's say that you're the person that is seeing your own issues here,
mm-hmm.
after listening to you this morning, but you're in a relationship, maybe with a spouse, where it's impacting, you know, how the two of you get along.
Right.
So would you initially recommend working with the person that is seeing the pattern, and then bringing in the spouse down the road and doing family therapy?
Well, I would recommend that the couple comes as a couple first.
Right out of the gate. Okay,
right.
That's good to know.
Right.
Okay.
And then there's no feeling of inequality,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, that you're coming on a
equal. Or you've told secrets about me.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Or you're going to be ganged up on.
Right,
or, yeah.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah.
So I think that's good
yeah.
to explain.
Maybe
mm-hmm. if somebody is calling you and saying, I want an appointment. What if they say, but I know my spouse will never come? Then what?
Well, then I would say come anyway, because it's kind of like a baby's mobile.
Mm-hmm.
If you touch one piece, the whole system can change.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So we have dynamic parts that all touch each other.
Right, exactly.
You're disturbing the homeostasis, if you will,
right,
of
right.
a situation, even if your partner says, no way
mm-hmm.
am I coming to therapy.
Right.
Go ahead and go.
If one person changes, the whole system is going to eventually change.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you as a therapist, I know I've done this,
mm-hmm.
but you can help them learn how to bring about some of that change very subtly, very, you know, gently.
Right.
You know,
right.
just by asking questions that help that other person think things through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always refer to it as the who, what, when, where, how questions. Don't ever ask why. Why puts
right,
up
right.
a barrier. But if you can do the journalistic method,
mm-hmm.
Then, you know, you don't have to say more than a sentence of how did you arrive at that conclusion?
Right.
And then be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let the person respond.
Right, right.
So it works exceptionally well with children, by the way.
Yeah.
It really, really does. Because most kids are used to being talked at.
Right, right.
And this is a pattern where you're actually engaging with them and,
right.
and talking more with instead of at them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any other thoughts before we close down for today?
Well, I think that you just have to be patient with yourself and... As a therapist, being patient, because it takes time to build trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you've been taught not to trust, you know.
What's your typical number of sessions today?
Well, it depends. EMDR is a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if we meet weekly, you know, these things resolve in talk therapy within, you know, a short period of time. It's
mm-hmm.
you know, again, EMDR is a lot faster. What I can do, really, they say the average therapy is about two and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
What you can do with EMDR is about 12 sessions, you know.
Right,
so it depends on whether you're using talk therapy or EMDR.
I know that, you know, with most managed care companies,
mm-hmm.
they're pretty specific on the number of sessions you're allowed to have. And it used to be, you know, I don't know whether that's changed, but it used to be 16 mm-hmm. sessions that were permitted. So you learned as a therapist to see somebody once a week for the first month.
Right.
And then you went to every other
spread
week and spread
yeah.
it out. And they
yeah.
had homework assignments in between.
Right.
But that way, you know, it wasn't so abrupt.
Right, right.
And the person had the ability to work with you for a longer period of time, resolving mm-hmm. things instead of feeling like, oh my God, I've got to run through this.
Right, so. Right.
Well, I certainly appreciate having you as my guest again.
Well, thank you again.
Hopefully everyone out there got a lot out of our discussion today. Most of us know people who either have addictions currently, or maybe we know them from our past, and maybe we're suffering from an addiction ourselves. Please go to my website, synergyconnectionradio.com, if you want to send somebody to this show later this afternoon if they missed the live version of it. And while you're on that website, you can sign up for a health newsletter, because many times the reason we have addictions is because we're physically struggling ourselves mm-hmm. with a health problem. So there's a lot of great information there. Play around on the website. And join us next Thursday for the Synergy Connection Show. Have a beautiful afternoon, and make this your best life.